Welcome to Pop Pantheon, the podcast where we completely overanalyze all of your favorite pop stars and then rank them in the official Pop Pantheon. This is your host, DJ Louis the 14th, reminding you to please rate, review, and subscribe to Pop Pantheon wherever you are listening to it right now. We are on Instagram and Twitter at Pop Pantheon Pod. I am at DJ Louiexiv. And we have merch at poppantheonpod.com and Patreon at patreon.com/poppantheon for weekly bonus episodes of the show. Last week, we were discussing Ariana Grande's Eternal Sunshine. That's a great episode, a great addition to our series that just came out about her. And also, I have a big announcement about that, which is that, as some of you might have noticed already, we know some people have already subscribed, but we haven't plugged it yet, but the bonus episodes are now available in Apple Podcasts in the main feed. You can get the audio only by subscribing directly in Apple Podcasts, and all of the episodes, the bonus episodes, will appear in the same feed as the rest of these episodes. So all you have to do is hit subscribe. You can Apple Pay. It's very easy. So if Patreon isn't good for you, this is a good alternative. We're really excited that we've been able to get that together for everyone. So Pop Pantheon All Access, weekly bonus episodes, either at patreon.com/poppantheon. Click the link in the show notes of this episode or subscribe for audio only directly in the app. All right, some housekeeping. And I know this is a lot of housekeeping, but I promise it's all exciting housekeeping. Pop Pantheon is hiring. Yes, we are looking for a new audio editor, freelance. If this is you or a friend of yours, we would obviously ideally like to work with somebody that's already familiar with the show, but we're looking for freelance audio editors. So if this is you or somebody you know, please email us at poppantheonpod@gmail.com. Tell us a little bit about yourself and let's set up a time to talk. Maybe you can come work with us a little bit. Again, this is a call out for freelance audio editors. poppantheonpod@gmail.com. Reach out to us and let's see if we can work together. Okay, upcoming events. On March 23rd, Gorgeous Gorgeous LA is happening at Los Globos in Silver Lake. Tickets for that are available in the show notes of this episode. Of course, Pop Pantheon Live, Tortured Poets, and the State of Taylor Mania with myself, Brittany Spanos, Hunter Harris, and Nora Princiati is happening at the Bell House in Brooklyn. As of recording, this is almost sold out. Perhaps it will be actually sold out by the time you listen to it. If there are still tickets available, you can get them in the show notes of this episode. And then the big announcement is that same weekend, the Friday before the Monday is the Taylor show at the Bell House, and on the Friday before, we are launching the first ever Pop Pantheon party. And this is going to be the first of a series that I'm really excited about. It's going to be called Taylor Mania. It happens the same night the Tortured Poets come out, and it will be at Parkside Lounge in the East Village. And I will be there playing Taylor songs from all eras starting at 10 o'clock. We're so excited about this. So it's like a whole Taylor extravaganza. As I mentioned, if you have tickets to the live show, if you don't have tickets to the live show, this is going to be a great way to have fun with your fellow pop fans, with your fellow Pop Pantheon fans at the first ever Pop Pantheon party. I'm so excited. So Pop Pantheon presents Taylor Mania. The dance party will be happening on April 19th. That's Friday at Parkside Lounge in the East Village, and tickets for that are available in the show notes of this episode. All right, a lot of things to plug. This week, we have an interesting episode. So Russ and I have been wanting to do this episode for a very long time and discuss a little bit how we, as a pop podcast, a podcast that is taxonomizing pop stardom, relate to the work and legacies of artists with complex and sometimes very troubling personal stories, controversies, etc. So we invited Trey Johnson and Kemi Elmaru on the show for a debate about how we deal with art versus artists when it comes to talking about the Pop Pantheon. And we focus specifically on two highly controversial but highly influential pop stars, Kanye West and Michael Jackson, and how everything that's come to light about them, sometimes through their own mouths, sometimes allegedly about them, has affected the way that we think about their legacies and how we personally interface with their music and how we as critics interface with their music. It was a really interesting conversation. I want to issue a warning that, of course, we do discuss sexual abuse, sexual assault in the context of this conversation. So if that's not something you want to listen to, I totally understand. You can skip this episode, but I think it's a very interesting and sticky, dynamic, complex conversation. I really enjoyed having it. So here is my conversation with Kemi and Trey. All right, so I'm here with host and culture writer for Dazed, Vogue, and more, Kemi Elmaru. Kemi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And I'm also here with writer on race, culture, and politics, and author of the forthcoming Black Genius, Trey Johnson. Trey, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so we're here to talk about a complicated and sticky topic today that Russ and I have been mulling over for a long time, both because we make a show called Pop Pantheon. The idea here is to index the history of pop stardom as completely as we possibly can. And we wanted to talk about this topic for two reasons. One is that self-centered reason, which is that we're constantly discussing how and when it's okay for us to broach topics of artists that have been canceled, I guess is the lightest way to put it, but many artists that have had very legit and horrifying, alleged in some cases, but scandals that have cause them to be ostracized or correctly perhaps like put into lights that feel like celebrating their music or attempting to go out and sort of like honor the fact that artists like Michael and Kanye and a lot of people we're going to talk to today have done things that have really hurt people both directly and then more broadly culturally. And we are constantly going back and forth about like what is appropriate, what isn't, how do we separate art from artist? And then as we've sort of been parsing that for ourselves in terms of our own programming, Kanye West, obviously, as he does frequently, has come back recently with a new album that has once again sparked a lot of the conversations around him and some of the more scandalous and upsetting things that he does and says. And increasingly so, I guess, more in the last probably 8 years of his career. And I wanted to bring both of you here to have a conversation about how we, as critics, as music consumers, as people that care about pop culture and pop music, deal with this stuff, especially when you're talking about artists like Michael, like Kanye, where you really can't talk about pop history in toto and ignore them. It's impossible. These are both artists that have had seismic impacts on the shape and scope of pop music and pop stardom. And it seems impossible if you're trying to be honest about telling that story to avoid them. And yet at the same time, there seems to be an onus, and it feels appropriate on some level, on culture observers and people that are talking about culture to make sure that we talk about them in a way that also acknowledges some of the trespasses that they have done. So that's kind of the scope of this conversation that I want to have with you, is like, how do we do that? How do we talk about these people, these incredibly important artists who are also very controversial and have done things that are in some senses unforgivable? So I think that that's where I want to sort of set the groundwork for us. Maybe we can start small and just talk a little bit about Kanye in particular as a way to get into this conversation. So I was wondering, Trey, if maybe you could give us a little bit, just in broad strokes, about the last however many years of Kanye. Kanye has obviously always been a bit of a controversial artist, but I feel like at some point, and I usually put it around 2016, it sort of tipped into something that felt like it started to alienate larger and larger swaths of his fan base. So could you just tell us a little bit about like the overarching trajectory of Kanye as a lightning rod in recent times?
Sure. Also, I'm like laughing to myself the idea that starting with Kanye is the idea of starting small in this conversation, because it's such a hot fucking mess.
It's all relative, Trey. It's all relative.
But I think you're right. You know, I think 2016 is like the threshold point. Broadly speaking, like a lot of it was the beginning of his like kind of villain era, moving towards Trumpism, very closely aligning himself with Trump as a presidential candidate at the time, but also Trump as a viable political force in the culture. And then you had all these other very strange things that he started doing. You know, he had the White Lives Matter t-shirt and stuff like that. He got into the big back and forth shouting match with Van Lathan on TMZ, where he was asserting the idea that Black folks who were in slavery, it was a mindset choice, and there were adequate means for them to escape or to disavow slavery at the time.
He said, grounded in reality. This reality has been forced upon us. It is a choice, just like when I said slavery is a choice. The reality, we can make our own reality.
And then, of course, there's just like the huge spate of comments he made around anti-Semitism, both elevating the ideas of lots of neo-Nazi type of thinking, but also touching on that like very sensitive third rail about the notion of Jewish American or Jewish control of media and culture and influencing and power in every pocket of particularly entertainment society as possible, and how much it was, in his thinking, detrimental to his expression, his freedom, but also the notion of his power. And then there are all these other things that started coming out as a result, right? Like he incensed so many people that he lost the huge Adidas deal. And in light of that, there were all the stories that started coming out about his time at Adidas, about how he was conducting himself during business meetings and graphic sexual stuff that he was showing as a way of like selling his vision and ideas. What hasn't helped those things too is that there are all these erratic examples of behavior that started getting linked to his political thinking each time too. So every time he had some type of errant behavior type of like show in public, which sometimes felt very knowing and like playing to a certain type of audience. But at the same time, again, it started becoming blurred with the idea that, of course, this man acts this way because he thinks this way. And so, like, you know, I think he's continued to unspool while also releasing, you know, tons of music, actually, ironically, during the entire time, which has been met with mixed results. So that's how I don't know if y'all would capture anything differently about that era, but that's how I would at least sum it up at first.
Yeah, I think the only thing that I would add is that, I mean, the saddest thing about this Kanye era is obviously he loves to play on the idea of the old Kanye and the new Kanye. But to me, it feels like he has like abandoned a lot of how he used to talk about his community and his role in the community. I feel like when he said that slavery was a choice, I think there were a lot of Black people who hopped off the train then. It was just like, we supported you and you're turning around and you're saying that it was our own fault that we were enslaved. Like, that just feels egregious. So I think the saddest thing is the political shift has been quite dramatic in this season, and that it feels like we're talking about two completely different people and two completely different artists, in my opinion.
What's really interesting to me is that on the one hand, obviously, he has crossed over into an operatically horrific persona in the era that we're talking about for all the reasons that both of you just laid out. And so he does feel like an entirely different artist in some ways. And yet at the same time, there's foundations for this sort of stoking of controversy that feel like they predate the 2016 era. In some ways, I think they're in ways that we probably as more like liberal-minded people might have related to more, but I think about like him boldly stepping out and saying George Bush doesn't care about Black people and that telethon, obviously the moment where he stepped on stage and set off a like really tiresome now after whatever, however, 15 year feud with Taylor Swift by going on and saying that Beyonce deserved the award over her, which I think also, you know, had a lot of like racial undertones to it from numerous angles. And even going back to like a song like Jesus Walks, where he's like, you know, using his art to very explicitly create conversations that maybe like pop music and pop musicians would shy away from, related to religion, related to God, etc.
So here go my single dog, radio needs this. They said you can rap about anything except for Jesus. That means guns, sex, lies, videotape. But if I talk about God, my record won't get played, huh?
So Kanye has always like had an element of his persona, I feel like, that has been meant to provoke.
Yeah.
And so there's this weird dichotomy, obviously, like all of that is entirely different than saying slavery is a choice or like being a neo-Nazi. Like, that's not the same thing. But it's funny because weirdly the ground was like softened in some ways. Like, it wasn't this entirely insane pivot. And then the other thing is that, and we're going to bring Michael into this conversation in a little bit, but I think one of the things that separates these two kind of scandalous pop superstars is that Kanye's stoking of controversy is like very integrated into his art from the beginning. Like, the art and sort of the public persona are very linked together with like whatever his personal ideology feels like it is. Whereas like, I think with Michael, as we'll talk about in a little bit, there's a bit of this kind of like cloistered separation between like this delicate lovey-dovey pop superstar Michael Jackson and then sort of like what we then came to know about him behind the curtain. So anyway, that was just one thing I was thinking about, Kemi, when you were talking about kind of like feeling like the old Kanye and the new Kanye. Like, I agree with you definitely on one front, and then on this other front I sort of feel like it's almost like a trajectory that feels like it's been going on for 15 years on some level.
Yeah, definitely. I think he was always very outspoken and he always loved to rant, but I guess they just became more and more unhinged. And I think those you could maybe be like, yeah, I kind of get it. Like, people don't really talk about Christianity in music. But then that's so different to him saying, I'm going to go DEFCON 3 on Jewish people. It's like, whoa, that's just... It's a very different avenue. Yes. I don't think I could have predicted that he would come out with some of the stuff that he's come out with. I knew that he didn't like to shut up, but I didn't know that there was a undercurrent of admiration for Adolf Hitler. I think those two things, like, you could not have expected those two things to align.
I also think, you know, I wish with my memory I could also attribute this woman's name, but I will never forget years back on a Facebook post that I was following, and Kanye was in the midst of some early form of antagonism in the culture. And I think this was around the Trump time, but there was a Facebook thread that was talking about him. This Black woman chimed in and she said, you know, it's wild that y'all find him to be a problem now when he has had repeated history and a long history of making derogatory music about women, and in particular, including Black women inside of the narrative of the music that he's making. One, I will never forget that because I was like, fuck, that's a really good point. And two, I think part of what I think is interesting about the notion that Kanye feels like such a type of betrayal now is that part of that betrayal is much more rooted in the idea that his expressions now incense like everybody as opposed to perhaps only women or only Black women. And so, like, you know, part of me, it's like every stage of his existence in the public eye has been some form of provocateur, like not just because of his like outspokenness through his art, music, in terms of like religion. You know, he used to talk about like the problems of capitalism and stuff too, but that same College Dropout album, which is now celebrating 20 years as Vulture comes out, like, it also had, you know, Workout Plan, and it also had a couple other tracks that had narratives that were still demeaning and dismissive or cynical about women in society. 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 and get them sit-ups right in. Tuck your tummy tight and do your crunches like this. Give head, stop, breathe, get up, check your weave. Don't... You know, I think as always with hip-hop, and I think particularly with men in hip-hop, those more gendered messages are given a hand wave. And they're much more routinely held to the standard of what do they have to say about much more magnanimous political commentary. And that is where they rise or fall as a notion of a hero to us. But we have to grapple with the fact that these men often, if not damn near always, have these much more unflattering, nuanced narratives around Black women. And I think just sexuality narratives that should be equally held to the litmus test, considering them to be a provocateur or a villain in their stories.
Gonna say, I think people are just so desensitized to misogyny in rap
that you
don't even think to go back and think of all the lyrics that are possibly offensive to women in rap, because I think as a rap lover and a woman, you just learn to tune that out after a while. Just for the enjoyment of the beat, I have to just tune out.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
It actually reminds me a little bit of how I used to feel about something that's less rampant now, but like the homophobic elements of rap that, you know, when I was growing up in the 90s, like, you know, a lot of rappers that I loved and worshipped and whatever, like, were just out here literally saying like disgusting stuff about gay people all the time. And I just remember kind of just being like, well, that's just part of the culture and, you know, who am I to judge? That is so interesting because, yeah, you're mentioning how that dates back literally to his first album when, you know, and I think in some ways you can split the Kanye sort of thing into three epics, one being sort of like the first run of three albums prior to the death of his mother, in which Kanye was seen as kind of like a cuddly figure in a lot of ways, I think, like the type of rapper that had broad appeal and was, you know, welcoming to a lot of different types of listeners, like the type of rapper that my mom kind of could get into in some ways. And then you have kind of like the 808s and Heartbreaks on Kanye, which like was definitely a little bit more of like a calcified, angry, like less inviting character, but also who made some of his most acclaimed work between, you know, then and Watch the Throne, Yeezus, I guess Yeezus and Life of Pablo kind of being like the end of that particular epic. And he was definitely a more abrasive character during that time period, but also was wholly embraced by the establishment, the music intelligentsia establishment at that point, and was having a ton of commercial success, you know, making music, as you said. I mean, Yeezus in particular, just, I mean, laden with misogyny. And you might think, if we weren't so deeply entrenched in the idea of misogyny as just part of hip hop culture, I guess, in a certain way, would be scandalous, I think, if you really listen to a lot of it. And then, of course, you have the kind of like post 2016 version of Kanye being like the third epic. I guess my question is, in light of what I'm laying out, in light of that framework, because as I mentioned, like through that middle period, he had a ton of commercial success and was not really called to task on a lot of this stuff. What has been the fallout of the post 2016 Kanye pivot towards far right extremism, towards anti-Semitism, towards anti-blackness in some ways? Like, what has been the fallout commercially? And then I guess after we talk about that, I want to talk about a little bit about how it's affected both of your ability to interface both with Kanye's current music and then with the older Kanye music, the old Kanye, as Kemi was pointing out. So let's start with what has been the commercial and, like, I guess, critical or discourse fallout related to Kanye's far right pivot in 2016.
The difficulty is that it kind of boils down to my own opinions around cancel culture not really being real. Like, everyone will tell you that Kanye has been canceled, but has he really? I think his most recent release just went to number one. So that doesn't really seem like a fringe figure. That's somebody who is enjoying just as much fame and popularity as he always did. He has a very, very, very loyal fan base. And obviously there was the breakup with Adidas, and that was quite a public breakup. It took place mostly on his Instagram as he kept screenshotting all of his emails, which is actually just so nerdy if you think about it. Like, why are you all of your emails in grid? It's so, like, that's how you can just tell that he's just like not as cool anymore, because, like,
so
he basically managed to break up one of his most successful fashion partnerships overnight with a lot of his comments. But both Adidas has recovered, and I think he's also making strides elsewhere in fashion just by reinventing himself and trying to take more control over the brand, which is what he was complaining about not having in the relationship with Adidas. So, I mean, in the moment, it obviously felt like, oh, wow, the wheels are really falling off. But I think with some distance, it's kind of obvious to see that everybody's attention span for controversy is very short at the moment. So it doesn't really seem to have had a massive effect on him as an artist or as a businessman, really.
Yeah, I would largely agree with a lot of what Kemi's saying, and would just add like another layer or two on top of it. You know, I think it's interesting. So much of like his relevance is tied to, like, you know, this break in Adidas, this break in culture. And I would actually say that the beginning of that break actually goes back a little bit earlier, because from my perspective, I think ironically, the biggest partnership break he had, as far as I'm concerned, began with his split with Jay-Z and Beyonce. You know, they like all very much disavowed each other in a lot of ways and went their separate ways. And I think he had that fallout with them at a pretty critical juncture point, right? They were all at the height of their powers in a lot of senses. And when they had their fallout, you know, the Carters as a duo entity have continued to skyrocket in a very, very certain type of way, while his star has fallen to a different, you can argue whether it's fallen or it's stayed in motion while other people have like kind of like lapped him in a lot of ways. But I think there was a real cultural split that happened when he had like that very public kind of like subtweety and a lot of tongue-in-cheek kind of fallout with Jay and Beyonce. And I think that did something around the perception of him and the mainstream hold of him early on. And then all these other things started happening, I think, as an additional heavy set of satellites around it. But to Kemi's point, I agree. Like, I don't think cancel culture is real. His album being number one is a reflection of two things. One, a continued ardent fan base, but also the mechanics of how the algorithm of both social media and the music industry works. Like, he has purposely yanked his album on and off streaming services in particular to make sure that he can kind of game the system to some respect to kind of get back to that number one spot, particularly as like Beyonce, Usher, Taylor have like dominated a lot of the charts, and he needs to have a foothold in music relevancy to make sure that he's still is seen as a cultural force. But I think the other thing about why he retains some level of popularity and relevance too is the acknowledgement of tapping into the wider American, and particularly Black American, political context now. For good or bad, and I think bad, Kanye more and more now speaks to a segment of the Black American, and I think in particular the Black male American political thought that actually is skewing towards the right and is skewing towards Trump. And does feel like, I think he has become, for a certain segment of Black American males, he's become a bit of an avatar around the idea of like, yeah, like these systems don't work. Like, yeah, there are people who are pulling strings behind the scenes the entire time that will never get us a chance. You know, like our mindset and our entrepreneurship can be the way out of poverty or into the social circle of power. And like, yeah, these motherfuckers are holding us back from being able to have that type of foothold in society. I think he speaks to a lot of the disenfranchisement that a lot of Black men are feeling about like feeling still relevant, still powerful, still alpha in a lot of ways in a lot of American cultural context and political context. While I don't subscribe to literally any of these schools of thinking, I have access to and have awareness of many other Black men who may not even necessarily even love Kanye, but they might see themselves reflected in some of the message and some of the anger that he feels about now being pushed to the edges of cultural and societal margins.
How does that square with, I mean, maybe it's because trying to make a like cohesive political ideology out of like what Kanye does and says is like a futile exercise. Because as you're speaking, I of course totally understand, you know, what you're describing about his persona. And then at the same time, how does that square with him going out and being like slavery was a choice? Those things feel like they should be oppositional. Like the idea that like, yes, I'm the voice for an idea that like there's an entire system that is keeping you down, which is like, I think a very resonant idea and like feels like obvious, yes. And then at the same time to flip around and be like, psych, like, you know, like the root of a lot of this is imagined. And maybe I'm the chump for trying to like make this into something that has like some sort of cohesion to it. But like, it does feel like he just comes out and says pretty oppositional or like portrays pretty oppositional ideas in this way.
I feel like you would have to zoom out and kind of think about the contradictions in general in the slide towards conservatism in the West. It's not a small topic. It's like how you get the Tory party in England talking to poor people about the fact that it's poor people's fault that they're poor and the working class keep voting for them even though their policies are only making working class people.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it's almost like him saying slavery is a choice might be seen as empowering to, you know, a certain section of men, Black men in particular, who want to, you know, take control of their circumstances and don't want to be enslaved by passivity or a palatability, and him like speaking the truth and going out there and speaking truth to power. I'm doing a lot of air quotes here that you can't really see on a podcast. but I think that might be where the appeal is and also where the confusion is if you don't subscribe to those ideologies or if you're a little bit more critical about conservative thought, you would think that those two things don't fit together. But as you said, there's a slide to the right within communities that people probably wouldn't expect, and he manages to perfectly fit into this era of the alpha toxic mask poster boy who's kind of not really afraid to say anything, but to everybody else it doesn't really resonate. Like, to me, what he's saying doesn't resonate. However, I see the posts under his social posts and I feel like, yeah, I do live and I'm just seeing a completely different, my feed is different. Like we're in it, we're all seeing the world very differently. So he speaks to people who aren't me. For them, he works.
What I was going to ask about is, or what I was going to kind of like try to parse out with you guys is that I get confused with like the question regarding like what the fallout of this has been, because in one way, I agree with what both of you are saying in that he clearly still is having number one albums. He's still around in our ears all the time. He's still like a cultural monolith in a way that like can garner attention by pretty much everything that he does. So we haven't marginalized him in that way. However, using just my spidey sense, and this could be what I'm going to kind of point to in a second, my own bubble, he does feel marginalized, at least in some ways in the world that like he used to be celebrated by. So like whether that be the music critic establishment or people that thought of themselves as conscious hip hop and pop consumers. And then maybe that's also a dated concept in some ways too. But there was this world in which Kanye was seen as the greatest artist of a generation, this unimpeachable music maker who set the terms for pop music, and everything he did was of great import and influence and celebrated him as probably like one of the top three most important, you know, musicians of the last 25 years, let's say, which probably is true in some ways, especially speaking of his, you know, earlier work, I would say more specifically. But like there is a way in which he does feel tainted or marginalized to me in that world. And I would say like, I just want to be conscious of the fact that I probably live in a bubble and I'm in the direct bubble in which he's been marginalized. So like that's something I'm sort of thinking about. But then as you were both speaking, I thought about the way that this connects to a broader trend in pop music that doesn't necessarily ride on controversy like this, but just the overall death of monoculture and siloing of pop stardom in general. Like whether you're Kanye West or you're Billie Eilish or you're whomever, anybody not named Taylor Swift or Beyonce, it seems like pretty much for the most part, pop stardom exists in silos. Like you can be at once a huge star to your like large, feverish, devoted fan base. And then there's large swaths of the population that can like move about their lives completely ignorant of what you're doing, artistically speaking, especially. Like, I think artists like Billie Eilish fit into that really well to me. Like, again, not for reasons of controversy like Kanye, but just because this is how we do pop stardom these days. Like, everything is niche. Even big stars are niche at the same time. So in some ways, I wonder if Kanye's fans have just changed, like his niche has changed, and like he's not a monocultural pop star, because if you're not Taylor Swift or Beyonce, like no one is a monocultural pop star really anymore. And maybe what it is that he's kind of shifted into the new skin of pop stardom in the contemporary social media age, which is just to like find a feverish cult audience that worships you and just speak directly to them. And you don't really need to appeal in four quadrants the way that like one did at the peak of Kanye's career, for instance. One did like when you're making Stronger, you know, for instance. So that's kind of what I was thinking. Like maybe the fallout is he's actually utilized the fallout effectively to reposition himself as a contemporary pop star that's operating in the new way that pop stardom is operating now, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's like pop music for populism. It's like he's soundtracking that shift. And like while we're, you know, talking about this, like he's on the fringes, if he's aligned with Trump and you're looking at the polls for Trump, is he even on the fringe, or are we? Like maybe we're on the fringe. And maybe he's just 10 steps ahead culturally, as he always kind of has been, but maybe this is now also feeding into his politics and the way he expresses his opinions and the sets and groups that he aligns himself with. Like, I completely agree that there are ways that he's isolated himself from the liberal media and the liberal, like, critic glitterati. But then I also think about the waning power that those sections even have.
Right, as we watch like all these publications like fold every single day, like, it's literally
just got gutted at Condé Nast. So yeah, I guess we're talking about him being on the fringes, and maybe he's having actually a great time and it's us that are having a bad time and are being pushed underground. You could also look at it that way, which is very depressing, and I'm so sorry to say that out loud, but it's just one way of looking at it, you know?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I was, as you're talking, I'm like thinking about what a moment it was when Pitchfork gave My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy a 10 out of 10, and like what a kind of like moment of zeitgeist that was for both Pitchfork and Kanye and like pop culture writ large. And it's like, you know, look where we are now. Like, I'm sure Pitchfork would be I haven't looked at necessarily, I should have refreshed myself on their reviews of Kanye's post 2016 albums, but I'm sure they were not 10 out of 10 reviews. But it's like, who really cares? Because who's really been marginalized at that point? It's probably Pitchfork, not Kanye, or at least both of them have in their own ways. I don't know.
God, you could cry, really, thinking about it.
Yeah.
Sure. You could, and many are.
Yeah.
Oh, I want to pivot the conversation maybe to something a little bit more personal for both of you, which is, look, I think we can sort of table stakes say that probably all of us have been impacted in our ability to listen to Kanye's new music through the lens of who he is now. I know, I'll just say for myself personally, I have a very hard time engaging with Kanye's new music in a vacuum. Like, I've tried to sit down with, like, recent albums, whether they be his gospel albums or they were Donda or Vultures the other day. Me and my boyfriend were sitting by and I was like, let's try to listen to Vultures for a second. And, like, can we even think about this without sort of being infected by the circus of torture hell that surrounds Kanye in my particular viewpoint? And it's impossible. I can't. I don't know how to engage with this music without just feeling disgusted by him because of everything that we've been talking about so far. So my question is maybe less about that and more about how this has impacted both of your abilities to interface with the pre-Kanye, the old Kanye. Like, how has this impacted your ability, to the extent that I'm assuming both of you had some form of affection for his previous music? How has this impacted your ability to listen to that music, or how has it changed your relationship to that music?
For me, very honestly, like, I can listen to his old stuff fine. I really can. Not because I don't have an awareness of what he is now, but he wasn't that then for me. And I love those albums. I, for a long time, am someone who, one, that early arc of albums, that version of Kanye, as I understood him to be, was closer to a version of Black male identity that I could see myself inside of. He felt very proudly niche inside of a larger Black male experience that presented lots of tension. You know, this was a guy that, like, wore pink. This was a guy that, like, expressed himself emotionally and could be, like, reckless about those emotions. This was a guy who actually was on MTV very, 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 very early on talking about the problems of homophobia inside of hip hop music. I'll never forget seeing him doing an interview commenting on that.
Hip hop was discriminate against gay people. Mm-hmm. They feel like they can't act. Hold on 1 second. Everybody, don't throw me off. I really want to say this. I want to say this to America.
That's Let's pick your mind.
No, he was just throwing me off just slightly. I wanted to just come on TV and just tell my rappers, just tell my friends, like, yo, stop it, fam. Mm-hmm. Like, seriously, that's really discrimination. To me, that's exactly what they used to do to Black people.
You know, he had this way about him that was, like, kind of this blend of artsy, nerdy, backpackery, but wanting to be cool, but seen as kind of nerdy. Like, you know, his entire existence was, for a very long time, a joke inside of hip-hop. Like, people were like, you are a producer only. Don't try to come at us with your corny-ass raps. Like, you are not a rapper. You don't have bass in your voice. You don't, you know, there were all these affects about him that didn't fit inside of the hip-hop schema as it was back then. And it's a big reason why I loved a lot of his music. It felt very fresh, new, and different for those first string of albums. And I think 808s is a monumental achievement. I really do. I think it redefined and opened up several other lanes inside of a subculture, inside of rap, that wouldn't exist without that album. So I really have no issues listening to his older stuff. I don't think it's a contradiction on myself. I don't think it is propping up anything about him in particular. It's damn good music. It is music that takes me personally back to different times and eras of my life. That's important grounding for me that won't go away. I think both what happened 2016 onward, though I like Life of Pablo myself. I think it's not his strongest, but, like, you can see the cracks beginning to form there. But I think what's probably the bigger thing that started happening is that as his music continued to evolve, culture and the culture of how we talk about music and the artists and politics was accelerating even faster during that time. And so Pablo in particular came out at a time where, particularly with Black Lives Matter, Trump, Obama, all these things happening, we were all being pushed to fully integrate all parts of ourselves into how we engage with everything. And he is a great lightning rod example of seeing what that looks like as an autopsy or an examination of filtering ourselves through pop artists, through music, through culture, through arts in general. So I think that's a big part of why 2016 onward, it's harder to talk about or to listen to him and to not divorce all these other things, because at this point now, we are firmly entrenched of a culture of all elements of things being on the table as we view and consume things.
Mm. In so many ways, this conversation is pointing towards, like, so much of what's happening with Kanye is related to what Kanye is doing, and so much is what's happening is, like, kind of like from almost the outside into Kanye. Like, it's like him changing and then the way we are all changing and the way that our culture is changing. It's all like a giant storm that sort of reoriented us around Kanye in a certain sense.
Absolutely. I think the Pitchfork conversation is a great example of that. Like, I would be curious to see how Pitchfork reviews were written pre-2016 versus post-2016. Right. In general. So I think right. It's not just a Kanye conversation. I think we're talking about how have we all been incentivized to talk about culture, and particularly, I think, talk about culture, politics, and identity from a binary perspective, right? There is a red light, green light way of talking about these things much more nowadays. And I think to your point around liberal media and Kanye, like I was like reading around before we had the discussion, he still is being talked about in liberal critical media circles. It's just that there's an inflection about how people are talking. Now it's about like how he and his music are less than and a joke and not about the merits of whatever he's releasing in general. Like now, you are much more purposely infusing, and I think in the liberal space, it's about like making him much more like this like exasperated, problematic, toxic punching bag now as you talk about his music. Like it's an in mm-hmm. to talk about your disdain for him.
That makes a lot of sense. All right, what about you, Kemi? How do you interface with Kanye's pre-fake cancellation, whatever we want to phrase, whatever the inflection point of 2016 is?
Yeah, I definitely still listen to old Kanye, and I think this will probably come up again and again in the conversation, is that I think when it comes to those songs, they are just like interwoven into my memories now. So I can't really stop listening to Jesus Walks because it's just like, it's just there in my head. I remember the first time I heard it. I remember being scared of the music video because I was really young. There's just so much of like the first albums of Kanye that are just embedded in my brain anyway. And then I feel like I always had like boyfriends who were obsessed with Kanye West. I remember watching My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy so many times, the visual album, so many times. I've seen that so many times. It was almost like it needed to be watched just to fill the dead space in like university halls. Like, you know, you're not really doing anything when you're at university. You're kind of jobless and bored all the time. So we would watch that a lot. Yeah, everybody had this sort of relationship with Kanye's music, as like we all sort of thought that he was a genius anyway, which is why it was always so funny that he would go on those rants, because it was like, we're saying that anyway. And kind of the more that he said that he was a genius, the more people would pull away and be like, oh, you're being a bit insistent about this. But I was already under the impression that we had already agreed that he was a genius, and all he needed to do was just lap that up gracefully, you know? So yeah, I think pre-cancellation, I can't even really say that he's been cancelled, but pre-Life of Pablo, Life of Pablo is definitely the point at which he stops being added to my playlists. So he's not up at parties and pre-drinks anymore. What do you call it? Pre-games? Is that what you call it?
Yes, that's right. Not
pre-games anymore. It's just sort of like, it goes from collective listening to sort of insular listening. Yeah. And if you're listening to it, you don't want anybody to know. So there's some recent songs that do get like a bit of play, but like they're not on the public playlist. You know, they're not on the playlist that everybody else can hear and be like, what the hell? You're still listening to this album, because then you just feel like trash. I think mostly, thank God for my public persona, mostly I just haven't really resonated with the music either. Like I said before, yeah. I think the lyricism hasn't really hit for me, especially that song that was like Poopity Scoop. It was like, okay, well, there's nothing here for me. Like, there's sort of like Kanye that you could scream in clubs. You're not going to be screaming Poopity Scoop in clubs. So. Yeah, it kind of got easier for me to just bow out at that point anyway, you know.
Boop-dee-doo-scoop. Scoop-dee-dee-whoop. Whoop-dee-scoop-dee-poop. Poop-dee-scoop-dee-scoop-dee-whoop. Whoop-dee-scoop-whoop.
How good is this episode? It's good, right? Well, great news, because if you like what you're hearing here, you're going to love what we're doing over on our Patreon channel, Pop Pantheon All Access, where for $5 a month, you'll get bonus episodes of our show weekly. You heard that right. Every single week, we're dropping more of the same searing, in-depth combos you love about all your most anticipated new albums by stars like Ariana Grande, Dua Lipa, and Tate McRae, just to name a few, parsing apart all the newest pop singles in our famous New Music Speed Rounds. And of course, diving deep on your favorite classic albums like Madonna's Hard Candy, Christina Aguilera's Stripped, and so much more, all with your favorite Pop Pantheon guests. All this, plus you'll get access to our Discord channel, input on future episodes of the show, and so much more. So sign up at the icon tier now at patreon.com/poppantheon or simply by clicking the link in the show notes of this episode. You won't regret it. Thank you so much for bringing that back into my consciousness. I had not thought about it in a while. I think it's interesting what both of you are saying. And Kemi, I just want to jump off of what you were saying a bit just now, because I think where I fall on it is, I guess, similar to what you're saying, which is that I mean, look, those records, College Dropout through Yeezus and Life of Pablo, some of my all-time favorites, like, period, no caveats there. Like, I just loved those albums. I respect those albums. I mean, defining albums. As you said, a lot of nostalgia just, like, really take me back in time. But I would be lying if I said that what's gone on now hasn't changed the way I listen to them. And, like, maybe that's true of every artist as we watch them age and change, and maybe in ways that are less violent than Kanye has changed in my eyes over the last whatever many years. But, like, I now find myself listening to those albums and, again, still appreciating their majesty, but also feeling like I am tainted, or just maybe not tainted isn't even the right word, but who Kanye is now informs how I interface with those albums. Like, it's part of the listening experience. Whereas the listening experience used to be a purer, unfettered joy and excitement. It's now some of that, and then some of kind of like a, this sounds like an insane comparison, but I'm going to make it anyway. It's like when you eat meat, but you don't think about, yes, like the fact that something's been killed. Like, when you first eat a Big Mac or something like that, you're like, wow, this Big Mac fucks. It's so good. Like, this is just delicious. Like, I love this Big Mac. And then maybe you watch like a PETA video online and you see like the way that cows are slaughtered in factory farms. And maybe you're still gonna eat the Big Mac and still think the Big Mac tastes amazing, but like, you're definitely also gonna think about the fact that like you saw that video. So like, in some ways, that is how I think about when I listen to like College Dropout or Graduation or My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy now, is like my respect for them as music and my memories and nostalgia for them and what they meant to me in my life is undiminished. And yet at the same time, there's another overlay in the mix as I interface with that music now. That's how I think about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely think there is an element of that. I think definitely depends on the context as well and the songs. Like, some of his biggest hits, I think if you put them on at a party, they're kind of so undeniably large that people will just dance anyway. I guess if you go to like B-sides and you're sat in a living room with your friends, then you might start having discussion where someone will be like, oh, isn't it a shame? Like, and then you've got to have the conversation about what's happened to him. But I think, yeah, in terms of like hearing it outside, like outside of private spaces, I think his biggest anthemic tracks, you can still slip them into a DJ set and avoid.
I was going to say, I find myself anxious about that. I guess it depends on the space that I'm in, but I definitely feel like a sensitivity and consciousness and anxiety about playing Kanye songs in DJ sets, like old ones. Like, again, I'll try to read the room and like sense what's happening, but like, I definitely don't feel like a freedom to just do that as I would have or as I used to all the time. I mean, I used to play them all the time, like nonstop. And I definitely, it's not that I wouldn't play them, although maybe I wouldn't. I mean, I'm trying to think about like the last time I really did that. I think I do feel, and maybe it's because I'm often playing in spaces where I think like the crowd is maybe on the more thoughtful side of this kind of conversation and like might actually be offended by it. So like, I'm trying to be conscious of that. I want to come back to all of this in one second because I want to broaden our scope for a second. So I want to bring the Michael Jackson part of this conversation into the light. So Michael Jackson obviously initially came under the controversy spotlight in an entirely different era. This was the early 90s. And at that point, when he was accused of sexually assaulting minors, essentially, and was, you know, very publicly put on trial for that, it's you know, a different time period. But I'm curious how, in light of everything we've been talking about Kanye, we think about Michael. Again, it's a really different thing in a lot of ways. First of all, he's now dead, so yeah. He's not here to speak for himself, etc. You know, I want to throw out that another turning point in the Michael Jackson story seems to be that HBO documentary Leaving Neverland that came out a few years ago, in which a couple of his alleged victims, you know, harrowingly chronicled in vivid detail a lot of what happened to them, the way they were groomed, the way that he sexually assaulted and raped them, etc. Allegedly, obviously, he's not been convicted of those things, but this documentary was pretty hard to turn your eyes away from. I will say for myself, also as a huge Michael fan, who tried to maintain, and I don't feel proud of this, some level of plausible deniability about everything that he had been accused of in the past. Once I watched that documentary, that was like a really big turning point for me personally. Like, that was the moment where I felt like it would be dishonest for me to like attempt to sort of say that any of this was untrue. Again, this is alleged in a lawful sense, but that was just my perception of it. I'm curious how culture writ large, and like, you don't get bigger than Michael Jackson. You don't, there's no more famous person. If you're talking about pop music, he's synonymous with the term at this point. So it's like, how has this idea, the idea of cancellation or the idea of reckoning with these concepts, affected Michael? And like, is it different than the way it's affecting Kanye for all of these various reasons? Again, what Michael's being accused of is also in many ways, like, not that words don't have power and everything Kanye says isn't like terrible in some ways, but also like, this is, I think, on another level in terms of like what we're dealing with here. How does Michael play into this conversation to each of you?
Okay, so I find this a very, very, very difficult topic because it comes up a lot, because I while people were even really talking about stan culture, all I can say is that my LimeWire was finding every single Michael Jackson track that I could, burnt onto CD. Yeah. Once YouTube was a thing, I literally watched every single interview that he had done. I think I had the Oprah interview on a VHS tape and would take it round to my friend's house and we would just watch the Oprah interview. And that was our evening. And we thought that was a good night. Like, that was a really good night. I was obsessed. I was obsessed. It's interesting because you said trial in the early 90s. Now, as I said, I was a stan. There was no trial in the early 90s. There was an accusation in the early 90s, and then he settled out of court. Right. Meanwhile, I don't even know why I know this, because that was 1993 and I was born in 1994. But nevertheless, the facts are there in my head. And like, the trial was when I was in primary school. So that's like early noughties. And I think I stayed up late to watch the trial, like the verdict for the trial. And I remember watching this woman release doves when he became, like, when he was.
I remember that person. Too.
I just remember watching the circus of that. But like, from a young age, being like, he didn't do it. He would never do that. He's so close to God and he only likes children because he's a child himself. And like, genuinely, I grew up with that in my mind. Now, as an adult, obviously, I had to reckon with quite a lot when the accusations come back up and you are now a fully fledged human being who can, you know, put two and two together and deduce that something strange happened with that man. Nevertheless, obviously, this is where most of my thoughts between how you treat the art from bad artists comes from, is that I can't find a way to detangle his work from my memories, from my life, from my taste, from my love of music, from my pride in Black music artists, and like the length that we can go to. Like, the, he was like stratospheric, like watching those videos of people like faint in his performances and like him going all around the world and being recognized wherever he was. Like, to me, I think that really did something when I was younger, to see a Black man, admittedly got less and less Black as time went on, but to see a Black man get to those heights was really important to me as a child, to like think about the lengths of my own creativity and the lengths of the creativity of the community. So I have found it very difficult to put him in the bin of musical history and pop cultural history. I just don't think for me, I can do it in my mind. I can critique his legacy. I can critique his actions, but I cannot take someone saying that I can't listen to his music. Like, that's just, it's not going to work for me. Like, that's like people's first steps. It's their wedding songs. It's like, it's there in their memories and in the pop cultural canon. So I think more or less everything that I think about separating art from artists comes back down to this question of what do you do with Jackson? And it's that I can't throw away Michael Jackson's work. And I don't think culture can erase Michael Jackson, because he was so integral to pop music that, I mean, how do you talk about Usher? How do you talk about The Weeknd? How do you talk about Justin Timberlake? Like, you can't even really go anywhere. And you contacted me off the back of NYT's podcast and me talking about Pink Panthers and the fact that Pink Panthers' first song is a sample. It's a Michael Jackson sample. And the reason why I loved it was because I could listen to it and nobody could say shit to me. Like, nobody seemed to realize my friends aren't as big as fans as I am. Nobody seemed to realize that they were dancing to Michael Jackson music and I didn't have to have a laborious conversation about not listening to him. So I could just slip that into playlists and still listen to it. Of course, obviously, what happened and the testimonies of his victims is terrible. And I can't take away from that. But what I'm saying is that to me, I've had to compartmentalize that element of his legacy and the cultural legacy of his work. I've had to separate those in order to stay sane.
I love hearing all that, Kemi. Thanks for sharing all that.
Yes, thank you so much, truly.
Yeah. So the first thing I will say that I think captures all this is that I spent years being co-chair for a nonprofit here in Philadelphia, where I am, called the Youth Sentencing Restorative Justice Program. And it was about like reconciling the idea that people who are in jail have made mistakes at some point in their life. And that many times with people paid for the mistake that they made. Often too, there were times that people were called out for making mistakes they actually hadn't made. But the singular most like grounding conversation I had was with one of the co-executive directors of the organization at that time. Her name's Joanna. And Joanna said to me over drinks one time, she's like, you know, part of why we do what we do is that we believe that people aren't the worst decisions that they've made in their life. I've often sat with that from a variety of scenarios and perspectives. And I think this informs a lot how I try to manage the case-by-case experiences I have with pop artists. Because I think in many ways, what we're talking about is, in many ways, these folks are about how we try to justify and navigate society as writ large. And so when it comes to Michael, I very much agree with Kemi in a lot of ways. And I'm older. I like literally grew up, not only that, literally that I grew up listening to Michael Jackson, but Michael Jackson's legacy and longevity means that my mother grew up listening to Michael Jackson, and like my grandparents have an awareness and an access as her parents raising her to listen to the Jackson 5. Like, you know, for me, what makes Michael an almost invincible, also named in one of his albums, pop culture entity is that he is a long-standing entity whose presence was insinuated in every aspect of American culture and life. Like, this is someone who was part of a family-oriented group as the Jackson 5. And then even all the things that I know I have aware, like lived through the experience of growing up, you know, Michael Jackson is the precedence of icon status of our latest stretch of life, because you know, this was an individual who had an amazing solo career, who back when music videos were still kind of an early thing, like I remember us literally making sure that we were home to watch the live broadcast of Michael Jackson music videos when they would first debut on network TV or MTV. We would pop VCRs in and tape them. I remember that, like, you know, nowadays we talk about the idea of wanting to dress like certain types of pop stars, but Michael Jackson, you could actually buy Thriller jackets, you could actually buy glitter gloves, you could actually buy the beaded jacket. You could dress as Michael Jackson. You weren't approximating your fashion style like him. There were items of his clothing reproduced to be like him. He had dolls made of him. He appeared in Pepsi commercials. His moonwalk was a seismic moment for American culture, like world culture and society, but certainly American culture and society in a lot of ways. So he is someone who had just, again, his entire presence bled into every aspect of, in particular, American life, and I would say in general global media. And then all of that is bolstered by the fact that this is a man who made incredible music for a very, very long time. I think he, like anyone else, eventually saw a precipitous fall with his music. Like, there's his later years music just isn't as strong and didn't register on the same scale. And you have to contend with all these things about him very likely being a child sexual abuser. And, you know, the crazy thing about life and the crazy thing about particularly the joy that we feel, the selfish joy that we feel around pop stars, music, and how the two together can make us feel is that we can always write a narrative that will make travesties okay in the context of our joy, context of our happiness, anything. Like, if it makes you feel good, you will always find a way to rationalize the most egregious things that happen around someone or something that you have a strong association with. I think it's both why it's like, I understand the context of having anxiety or a calculation around playing someone like Kanye's music in a public space or outside of a private space. But it's also why, like, I can't hold all that. Like, because a lot of this is about our sense of goodness and projection as perceived by other people by way of our consumption of many other things. And the fact is that we all, like, you live a long life, I guarantee you, you have a life of contradiction. And so the role of culture critics, the role of cultural conversations is to help people to have a roadmap for understanding why we make the choices that we make. It won't always be sustainable or fair to tell people what roads they should take because of artists. You can inform people around what these pathways are and what these lineages are. But I think it becomes real tricky when you tell people that they are good or bad because they choose to indulge in a certain type of pop artifact or person. Like, we're a composition of many things, and I don't think you can reduce anyone's personhood or individuality. I listen to Kanye just as much as I listen to Janelle Monáe, to Blood Orange, Steve Lacey. You should not be able to pin my entirety of thought or humanity because you might see in the sidebar of Spotify that I'm currently listening to Vultures One. Like, those things just feel disingenuous to how we experience life in general, let alone art overall. So, like, yeah, I am comfortable with the contradictions and the tensions that come up with all these stars. And I know that, like, my choices around these things are a reflection of my own constant contradictions. Like, what does it mean that I feel a road to disavowing a segment, or at this point now, Kanye, but I will, like Kemi, probably hold the ground pretty firmly on Michael Jackson, who sexually abused children. Like, you know, you have to just own that those are contradictions about ourselves. And you have to examine, like, what does it mean? What we do when we don't get passes around things?
Yeah. Thank you both so much for all of that. So much of what you're saying resonates so much with me and is kind of helping verbalize a lot of what I've been thinking about this, which is, in my personal experience, I'm very much like both of you. I mean, I would go as far as to say, like, the reason that I'm doing what I do, the reason this podcast exists, all of that is largely because of my absolute obsession with Michael Jackson. When I hooked into Michael Jackson, that was like the moment that I like appreciated what pop stardom could be. Like, he is to me the gold standard in every regard. He is the person to me that invented what pop stardom is as far as we're all concerned today. And I mean that he was able to hit it in all of the ways that I value, whether that be on a purely brass tacks musical level, the quality, the detail, what he was doing in terms of creating a post-genre version of what pop music should be, to the performance, to the public persona, to the visual aspect. I mean, everything we conceive of as pop stardom today, and everything that I base a lot of what I do and talk about all the time is directly related to the fact that at a certain point, Michael Jackson became the god of this to me, and I worshipped everything that he did. And he is the tone setter, he is the agenda setter for the entire concept. So I'm with that. And at the same time, I also want to caveat and say, I believe everybody is a person of agency who can make their own decisions about what they're comfortable doing and not doing. And I would never begrudge anybody who did say, I don't want to listen to Michael Jackson anymore. I don't want to listen to Kanye West anymore. I completely understand that. Like, there's certain things that hit us all different personally. Like, there's other people and transgressors in pop culture that just for whatever reason, like, hit me in a different way maybe. And I don't really want to listen to them or watch their movies or whatever it is. And like, I totally get and understand that. I think the thing that I land on ultimately that I struggle with in some ways in our discourse surrounding this stuff is exactly what both of you were getting at in what you both just said, which is that I believe as a culture and especially as cultural critics and people that want to discourse about this stuff, that we have to get to a place where we can hold multiple truths at once. This is something that happens internally with us all the time as human beings, as we reflect and on the quest to understand ourselves personally, we have to do that. Work. We have to learn how to allow multiple seemingly contradictory things about ourselves to exist simultaneously and not view that as a problem. And I believe that that's true in our cultural discourse and the impulse in broader cultural discourse. Again, anyone's personal decision is their personal decision. But in terms of our broader cultural discourse, to say, I don't want to talk about Michael Jackson anymore because of this is A, not possible. As everybody's been laying out, I think, very beautifully in what you're saying. It's just not possible. If you care about pop music, there is no way to not have Michael Jackson be part of that conversation. It's just, it isn't possible. Maybe it would be easier to cancel somebody that is less important and to like erase them from the conversation. Maybe that's more possible. Although I don't think it really is, but it's easier. Michael creates a really interesting study in all of this stuff because of his import, because of his influence, because of the way that he set the agenda for the entire idea. We can't do that. It's not possible. And it would be dishonest. It would be lying to ourselves and to the world to sort of say, hey, we're going to pretend this didn't happen or that he wasn't here, which I think is a demand that some have put out there. And as much as I've tried to think and kind of pull this apart and question my own biases, and I, again, was deeply affected and impacted by Leaving Neverland in particular. And like, it really did alter my perception of him forever. No question. Doesn't matter what comes next. It was something I could never turn back from, actually, after I watched it. And I think a lot of people felt that way. But I don't believe that even if we do believe these things to be true about Michael Jackson, that that means that we just do not talk about Michael Jackson anymore. That's not the answer to these problems. And what I do think is the answer is that we let it be part of the discourse about Michael Jackson. We let that truth exist. Similarly to what I was saying about the way Kanye's recent antics have not caused me to not listen to Kanye's music, but it has definitely become part of how I listen to Kanye's music, both past and present. It's part of my lens on which I view Kanye. I feel similarly about Michael, which is like, this has in some ways impacted the unfettered joy that I used to feel in listening to The Way You Make Me Feel or Don't Stop Till You Get Enough or whatever. Like, it has. It's there. It lurks in the corner. And I believe that that's how it should be. Not everything you view in life is always viewed the same way as you get older, as you learn more about things. It impacts the way we look at anything in our lives. And I believe that, like, we should be able to have all of these things, the respect, the awe, the acknowledgement of the achievements of one of the most important, not just musicians, but pop cultural figures ever to exist. And we get to also understand that, like, what we now pretty much know to be true, or what allegedly seems to be true about Michael Jackson, is also part of how we consume Michael Jackson and how we talk about Michael Jackson. And so that's how I intuitively feel about like what our role is as people that are discussing culture in this way. And for me, particularly, someone who's trying to taxonomize pop stardom should approach these topics is like, we approach them, we are honest about them, we don't erase them, and we allow all of the truths that we now know to be part of that conversation to be part of the conversation. And it's now part of it. I think it would be equally disingenuous of us to go forward and just talk about Michael Jackson as an untouchable, perfect pop machine that like nailed it on every level and not talk about the other part of it. So it's like, we have to be able to allow both of these things to be out in the discourse, because otherwise I just think we're telling lies, and lies are rotting, horrible things no matter what part of ourselves or culture or discourse they exist in. So that's like my general POV on it. It's like, we can't just talk about Michael Jackson as this perfect deity anymore like we used to, because that would be disingenuous, but we also can't not talk about Michael Jackson as all of the amazing things that he was.
A couple of really quick things too. It's like, again, I think maybe the benefit of having, or my experience of having lived through Michael Jackson's arc of time, for a significant part of that time. Is that, like, again, you know, I think we have to be careful about how we curate the story of these folks, because I can readily access the fact that, like, Michael Jackson actually walked a constant polarity around him the entire time, even when he was at his zenith. Like, he was both wildly beloved, but then also seen as intrinsically everyday weird. Like, there was always a simultaneous conversation about Michael Jackson, about, like, yeah, this guy is this amazing pop artist, but he's pretty fucking weird. There was the Elephant Man bones stuff. There was Bubbles. There was his relationship with his sisters and stuff. There was his skin coloring and his accident. And there was his voice. There was the questions around his sexuality. There was his labored performance about where his romantic love story did or did not. Like, there was never
this Marie Presley.
Yeah. I mean, there was never this clean story about Michael Jackson. And I think there's this reverse rewriting about him often. I'm like, yeah, that's mostly true, but it's not entirely true. We always actively talked about him being strange, weird, maybe gay, maybe this, maybe that. Maybe, like, there's always an additional conversation happening about him. The other thing I think is that I think helps people have the dissonance around many of these artists, not all of these artists, but many of these artists, is that, you know, when we're talking about sexual abuse, when we're talking about some of Kanye's, like, outlandish vitriolic comments, I think part of why people are able to shelve these things is because these folks' music, it's not like Michael Jackson's making songs about sexually abusing children or even hinting at doing so. And so I think there is a chasm between those two. I would say largely up until recently, many of Kanye's, like, public political comments did not live inside of much of his music at all. And I think those are the ways that people have been able to still be able to, like, you can listen to We Don't Care What People Say, which has its own kind of political context to it, and not have to worry about what it has to say about Jewish people or what it has to say about Black women or what it has to say about Trump and stuff, because they're not living inside of the same sphere together. They're just inhabited by the same person. The last thing I'll just quickly say too is, like, why all this is tricky is around the weird slight role we have as a culture around this, because in some respects at this point now, I look at the framework that we use to judge artists, and I wonder to the degree of which we hold that framework in place still, when some of our biggest pop stars in the world, or our Taylor Swifts, our Beyoncés, Donald Glovers, whoever, people who are seismic to the culture, are now wildly silent about a global travesty and genocide that's happening at the same time. And when we talk about this merging of political context, pop artistry, canceling, and things like that, like, the question of when we graft these onto people and their legacy and what they do and they don't stand for and what they do and they don't do as who they are as public culture-defining personas, it is very interesting to watch how we continue to apply that in this current moment that we're in right now. Because part of why we're able to judge Kanye the way that we are is because we are also judging him against the context of politics in a current moment or current moments. And so, like, the same standard arguably is being applied or is tried to be applied. But I think, again, it's, like, kind of distanced itself during what is actively happening right now and the extent to which that we are hands-off about this when it comes to folks like Beyoncé or Jay-Z or whomever who are wildly silent about something that feels activating and activated for many of us right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's also interesting and of note the way that we treat different people differently. I mean, it's not lost on me, and I think it should be stated that, like, a lot of the subjects of our conversation today, and I would like to, we can throw R. Kelly into this mix too, are Black men who are, you know, obviously, like, get held, like, I feel like Kanye, Michael, and R. Kelly are constantly kind of held up as, like, examples of, like, artists in this sphere where it's like they've wronged and we kind of have to cancel them. Let's just say, if you want to apply these standards, we would have to bring Elvis into the situation. We'd have to bring Frank Sinatra into the, like, there's lots of artists.
Phil Spector as well.
Phil Spector. I mean, like, listen, we'd have to bring a lot more artists into this conversation to have some sort of integrity or honesty around how we're acting in this way or how we're treating artists in this way. We'd have to bring a lot more pop figures that aren't just these three men into the conversation if we really were talking about, like, erasing them from pop music history. Like, we'd be erasing a lot of people from pop music history if we were really holding everybody to the same exact standard. So it is interesting, and I think worth noting in this conversation, that we often center it around these three Black men, I think.
Yeah, like, we've arrived at a place where that's naturally where I was gonna go. Because essentially, right, you, if you erase the bodies of work of people people who are bad or have done something that is morally unpalatable, we quickly start to run out of art. Like, not just even in music, just historically, the more you dig into artists, I mean, artists are just a generally mad group of people anyway, and they're a very tortured, very dark section of society, the more you look into them. Like, I think when we first got into a conversation, I was talking about Jungle Book and how I obviously watched Jungle Book when I was younger, but the writer of Jungle Book was just a flagrant racist. Like, he also wrote about the white man's burden of having to colonize and basically make black people and people of color less bestial through colonization. And it's like, but you're still going to watch Jungle Book. Do you know what I mean? And when you watch Jungle Book, you don't caveat it to the three-year-old child. Like, by the way, the guy who originated this tale was a racist. You just let them watch Jungle Book, because art is kind of like water. Like, once something becomes a part of the canon and becomes just a part of like human behavior, like you show that to your kids and you just leave them in front of the TV, that art kind of has nothing to do with the artist in a way. It becomes bigger than the artist and their legacy, and it's like water, you can't catch it. So there's a chance that in a couple generations, or, you know, 10 generations time, all of these things will just be a part of the fabric of society, but people will just have forgotten the story of the artist. That's also completely possible. I mean, that's if, you know, climate change take us all out immediately. But like, it also then raises questions about, you know, everyone's personal relationships with the art. Like, another thing that I keep bringing up the conversation that we had before, like, people aren't privy to some like phone calls that we've been having and we've been gossiping outside of the listener base. But I was saying to you that I had a friend who always used to get at me about my Michael Jackson problem. You know, like, I've got a playlist called "He's Dead, Now Let Me Live," because like, if anyone hear it from my room, they would be like, I can't believe you're still listening to him. And it's like, please just let me just have like a few moments every once in a while where I'm just allowed to just go back and listen. But that same friend, I was like, look, if this happened to you with someone that you really loved, I think you would find it really difficult. It's really easy to advocate for the erasure of an entire catalog when you didn't have the same relationship with that catalog. Case in point, he loves Harry Potter, like watches Harry Potter every single winter. He also advocates for trans rights. It's very hard for him to now not have a Christmas where he doesn't watch Harry Potter, and now suddenly misses art, separate art from artists, which I've been saying for ages. He's finally coming around to what I've been saying, where it's just like, it would be really hard for me to untangle this from my habits, from, you know, my day-to-day life. So it really does come into play just how invested you are in the artwork itself. And then you were saying that Michael was a controversial figure his entire life. I think just even if you like look at stan culture in general, I think they must be the first rabid stans, Michael Jackson fans, and that is a fandom in defense. Like, that originated from him being constantly hounded. Like, he could not go outside. The British press called him Wacko Jacko. Like, he was always being judged, and I think that's why they rode so hard for him, is because like, there was obviously always a counter narrative to his stardom. And we said that that didn't really come into play in his music, but like, it kind of did. Like, you've got Leave Me Alone, where he's clearly talking about press frenzy around him. Just leave me alone. He did start to imbue his art with his real life, like black and white. That was ostensibly because he was white as hell at that point. And like, it was quite controversial in the extended cut that he turned into a Black Panther, because, you know, he's trying to talk about race relations, but really not even get to grips with like the fact that his race has ostensibly changed and he's not really talking about it. He put Macaulay Culkin in his music videos. And that was around the time that people thought his relationship with children was quite strange, and people found that quite inappropriate. And then to link him back to Kanye, I was listening to They Don't Really Care About Us the other day, and he had his own anti-Semitism controversies. Like,
yes,
the lyrics
in
The lyrics and they don't really care about us. There is anti-Semitism in that song, like him saying Jew me, me. That did not go down well, and that really doesn't get appraised much at all. But there are some lyrics in that song that really are close to the line. So there are like a lot of parallels between Michael Jackson and Kanye. It might just be that we're so far away from his controversy that we can't really feel it anymore. And there's that sort of flattening of someone's legacy. But yeah, I think they kind of both had this knack of using the controversy to feed back into the projects and get people like really not excited for the project, but get people talking about the project. It's like the marketing for both of them is actually quite similar.
And all pop stars do that. I mean, look at Taylor Swift does. I mean, like, we could talk about the differences in the controversy, but like, a good pop star knows how Ariana Grande is currently doing it on her new single. Like, it's kind of part of the Bible of pop stardom that you should find creative and sly ways to weaponize the controversy around you into your art. I mean, that is just pop star 101. And of course, a lot of that comes back to Michael and Madonna and whatever, that era of pop star.
And I was just going to like underscore a particular thing, because I forgot about this until you brought it up, but they don't care about us. Again, I remember this because I am of an age and of a time, but it's actually the current day version of it is actually an even more watered down version of it, because his original had a Jewish slur in it in particular, and there was such a vehement backlash about it. He was asked to remove the term from the song, and I think he had to re-release. I think it appeared both in a music video and in the original iteration of the song. And he was asked to remove that. It was a huge controversy at the time where he was asked to review this K word, racial slur, referring to Jewish people. And, you know, and I think it was a huge moment for a conversation around Michael Jackson, because he was seen in such an unvarnished way in terms of his music, while, again, still seen questionable in his personal life, where there was such a series of questions about him in his personal life. And I think he trolled on some of those things. I think he wanted to be left alone. I don't think that was the same as him directly engaging with his most hurtful accusations about his life that I don't think he, for lots of reasons, he didn't really directly grapple with. Kanye seems to be more positioned to be antagonistic about directly engaging with some of the commentary about him explicitly, but Michael never could quite confront those things dead on. I think he did a lot of things that were like market managed as a way of like softly acknowledging conversations about him, but never really did. He was not a confrontational man.
100%. Maybe to like land us here a little bit, do you guys have a sense of like maybe some sort of universal something that we could leave the audience with in terms of this conversation about art and artists? Like, is it the kind of thing where as you all approach this in your own listening habits or your own whatever, that you sort of take it on a case-by-case basis? Is there some sort of universal maxim you apply to how you interact with these kind of ideas between somebody that's transgressed in some way and their art as your own code of ethics around this kind of thing? Is there a universal code of ethics that you each apply to this idea, or is it just the kind of thing where it's like we all have to feel our way through this as individuals, as consumers, on a case-by-case basis and just take it as it comes? How do you feel about that? It's just kind of like a global idea as we try to kind of wind this conversation down.
You know, my mind is split on this type of thing, because I would say my general life maxim is around art in general, I would say, is your taste is not your humanity. Like, you are going to have an abundant diet. Like, look, some of my most sanctimonious friends indulge in really trash reality TV too, which is a ripe ground for lots of isms. And so, like, again, your taste is not your humanity is one thing. And I say that in part too, because I think we're inured as a culture nowadays to leverage people's tastes to police people about who they are and give a notion, a singular encaptured notion about who people are as a result. And I think that's ridiculous. That addresses the individual. I think that does not address the collective and society. And when I think about the importance of a collective and society, I think we might understand the opportunities to make different and tough choices, because some of what we should be collectively having conversations about is how to root out the things that these people are doing or have done that are not about the society or the world that we want to continue to build and have people thrive in. And so in that instance, like, we can't just say like, vaya con Dios, to each their own, go as you will. I think there is also a collective responsibility. This is why, again, come back to like the moment that we're in right now as a political context, as we are watching a conflict happen both between Israel and Palestine, but also what's happening Congo, Sudan, is that art needs to also be the space where we critically, collect effectively talk about, either through art or through artists, what is the world we actually want to advocate for and build? Because I think, you know, we were talking earlier about how we've become normalized around certain types of messaging inside of music, inside of genres of music. But the pool should be about, in the collective space, should be about not how we continue to settle on giving aspects of things and travesties of past, but actually how do we engage together on rooting those things out or reconciling or addressing these things, because they can't continue to happen. And I think I worry that, like, as we talk about individual tastes, case-by-case conversations, it allows the festering and the continued festering of a lot of bad things to continue to go deeply unchallenged, unaccounted for. But I think we can also have a conversation about, like, what does it mean to either elevate artists who don't traffic in misogyny or in homophobia or in whatever, in any genre of music, but as we talk about things like hip-hop, but also to how do we hold folks who can stop the internet, break the internet, can divert our entire attention with the release of an album or a song? How do we also talk about the importance of having those folks be, or those platforms that they create around them, be spaces for conversation about what is actively happening as people die every day around us senselessly? And what is the opportunity for our biggest pop culture stars and public figures who can stop and divert our attention in a collectively, it feels like, in a certain type of way, the last vestiges of like monoculture entities and personalities, what is the collective conversation we have around the weight to which we hold them and the spaces they create to a standard of collective healing, collectively addressing politics, and collectively addressing harm in society?
Kemi, you have anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, but it's not going to sound even half as smart. I was just going to say that what people should personally do, I had all these like stupid little rules around R. Kelly and MJ at one point, mostly R. Kelly because he was still alive. But I was like, if I want to go back and listen to like I Believe I Can Fly, maybe I do it, but I pirate it so that he doesn't make any money from it. Because I think where you feel like real trash is if you are still propping up and lining the pockets of someone who is actively awful and still at large. Like, you don't want to really be a part of bolstering someone's like career when they've done something actively terrible. And this is before he was in jail. And I think Spotify as a platform has kind of tried to play its part and hasn't really figured out what its part is to play. So like the royalties from R. Kelly, I think they went to his victims. That might have been because he already owed them money, but there was a certain amount of royalties that ended up being given to his survivors, which I think is a really good system. Like, if someone's done something that's like an active crime, then maybe we just funnel all the streams to like a charity that deals with the genre of crime that they committed. Like, that's actually there for activism. That'll make people feel good. That's activism. And then I think there was that, I've never said his name out loud. And to me, it looks really French, you know, like XXX Tentacion. Like, what? How do you say that name?
I think you said it right. I think you said it right.
Famous
French artist, XXX Tentacion, yeah.
Yeah, French provocateur XXX Tentacion. I feel like they tried to take him out of some playlists because obviously when you put all the people in playlists, you end up like building their streams. And I think that was happening a lot with just like awful SoundCloud rappers were kind of using their at-large criminal law to actually boost their streams and Spotify trying to not play a part in that. So I guess just trying to think about the mechanics of controversy and you actively bolstering someone's income from controversy is just something that we should be all mindful of. I'm not advocating that everybody go out and like illegally stream, but like, yeah, maybe everyone should just illegally stream bad people's music. We get the art, but the artist doesn't actually benefit from it in any way, shape, or form. Yeah.
Love it. I think that's amazing. All right, well, this conversation could go in a zillion directions. I feel like we could keep talking for 3 hours, but that's going to make my editing job absolutely punishing. So I'm going to call it for us right now. I cannot thank you both enough for being here, Trey and Kemi. I think we should go out on They Don't Really Care About Us, because I feel feel like that encapsulates a lot of what we were talking about in our conversation. And, you know, something to chew on. How do we consume this stuff and hold multiple truths at once, I think is the gist of like where we are on all of this. So anyway, here's Michael Jackson's They Don't Really Care About Us. Trey, Kemi, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you both.